Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Thank you for tuning in. It's a beautiful day to be alive, a beautiful day for a new episode. And it's beautiful that we have some really cool sponsors on the show. One of them happens to be Wolf Nation, WULF Nation, Wake Up Live Free Apparel. Just apparel for men, women, and children, designer clothing. I think you guys are going to like it. Go check it out. Go check out their website at wolfnation.rocks. They're taking direct orders of all sorts of their new products. So again, that is Wolf Nation. Wake up, live free. Now, we are also sponsored by Manskirt Brewing. Manskirt Brewing is a craft brewery located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Just a really great spot to go get a beer, hang out, play some cards, grab a pint, try one of their 8 seasonally inspired ales. They have a new secret beer made on their small batch brewing system. You need to ask for it since it won't be on the menu. It's called Rose Gold. It's a golden ale that was flavored with rose petals from Well Sweep Herb Farm. There's only 15 gallons of it, and it's gone. So it's a secret beer. Okay, kind of like, you know, you got to do like a secret knock to get into a party. You got to ask for it. Okay, so again, go check out Manskirt Brewing. Now, Trivia Revolution is a trivia company based out of New Jersey in beer bars and breweries. It's craft beer themed. Come on out, play trivia. You could be in last place and still win. There's a bonus item each week for you to check out on Facebook and whatnot. So again, that is Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, today on the podcast, we have two guests, two Aarons. Okay, two Aarons. First, we have Aaron, or AJ Muss, who is an Olympic snowboarder. Just a really cool guy. Got a crazy story to tell, and I'll leave you to that to check it out. And we have a man by the name of Aaron Yoder, who holds the world record for backwards running. Okay, so we have Aaron Muss and we got Aaron Yoder, two awesome Aarons. Let's get to the podcast. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is AJ Muss, 2018 Winter Olympian, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Now, this is Aaron Yoder from Kansas, proud American, and I'm the backwards mile world record holder, world champion, and I'm here doing Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Mike, how are you?
We're doing dandy, my friend. Yourself?
Dandy, dandy, dandy.
Mm-hmm.
So welcome back, guys. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. If you're tuning in for the first time, I'm Scott, and out there is Mike. And each week we just try to bring on some interesting people to talk to, period. And then, like, in between that time, we try to, like, be relatively entertaining.
Somewhat.
So, yeah, welcome back, guys. It's been a real this week. It's been real.
Oh, it's been 100?
Well, it's been 100-y.
Oh, man.
No, I mean, I don't know. It's, like, been one of those I don't want to start off with, like, bad news, but it's been one of those weeks where, like, you hear, like, a couple stories in a row. You're like, God damn it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you hear one, you're like, that's sad. You hear two, you're like, ah, God damn it. But you hear, you know, the old saying, it, like, comes in threes or twos and threes. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems like it really does. It seems like it's never just one thing. Like, you know, it's always, like, a couple things that you hear. Yeah, I mean, before we get into that, let's get into some positive news. You got nothing going on.
Yeah, nothing happened at all. Nothing happened at all.
So what went down the other day?
Oh, last Friday. So Friday was the official
the official
request for engagement to my lovely fiance Isabel, which went through.
You sound,
it was like a bank loan.
I was just gonna say, you sound like you just filed an insurance report. Like, hey, my claim went through.
Yeah, my credit score is way better right now. It's awesome.
My claim went through and everything was approved. Wow. Well, why don't you tell us a bit? First off, congrats. I mean, we talked about this last week a little bit. So how did it go down?
I mean, we kind of like what I was alluding to last week. We knew we actually had a wedding date and had the ring and everything, but I pretty much told her when the ring came in, it's like, all right, I want to have it and give you like a real, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about. Like, you knew, you guys kind of arranged it and knew, but how did you still want a surprise? Like is that
yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's what it was. I mean, we talked things out. I mean, obviously with her moving in the home, it's like, obviously we're going to go through all these steps and whatever. And we're kind of non-traditional because it's a very quick turnaround because my parents go away to Florida in October. My sister, she just got married on the 4th of July weekend. Her new husband, he gets very busy in September. So we kind of figured we'd have to do the marriage around the end of August.
And
so,
the Satanic Church was very booked.
Well, yeah, it was very. That's why we're doing it in the backyard, and hopefully Satan travels. You know?
Oh, he travels. But, he travels.
Yeah. So we kind of knew everything was happening, but when we got the ring, I said, well, I want to actually officially propose to you in some way and figure it out. So last Friday, we're playful, the two of us. We're not traditionalists and all that, where it's like make up a whole ordeal, go to a fancy restaurant, have violins playing and all that.
Have violins.
Violins.
have violence going on around
I'm
us.
Marrying this woman. Kill each other.
Attack. Attack in my name.
Satan, do you approve? So what I figured out, and all, I had this plan down. Me and her kind of do this fun thing with each other. When Derek leaves the room and they don't bring their phone,
you shit on their shirt.
No, oh, that's not what happened. Oh. What we basically do is we grab their phone and we'll go into their Facebook or something. We won't post it, but we'll write something like just freaking weird and insane. So when they close the other's phone, so when they finally get to their phone and open it up, they'll be on their Facebook page about to post something like, oh my God, I can't believe I crapped my pants for the fifth time this week, or God, I'll put on her thing and all. Thank God I'm a Phillies fan because the Mets suck this year. Something to that equivalent. That. Yep. We'll talk about it later. But in any case, so what I did was we were just like cleaning out the basement. We got that room somewhat furnished for now. We got a couch and a nice TV, and she went upstairs to get a few things. So I got her phone and I write her a really nice message on her phone, basically proposing to her. And I put her phone aside. Then she comes down and she's like freaking out about a bag of potatoes that she thinks is old. I'm trying to like hand
so
her
romantic.
The phone. Yeah. I'm trying to hand her the phone like, hey, you know, you left your phone here waiting for her to like open it up. And she's like, you know, you got this big bag of potatoes and it's got all these fungus and everything going in there. It's going to stink up the place. You got to get this potatoes out here. Honey, why don't you look at your phone and
you
get these potatoes
out of
here.
Spoke to her in like potato puns. Like, I hope we can be best spuds forever.
I hope our love mashes together.
I want to get in between your fries.
So she gets the phone and she sees she's got something on her Facebook.
I hope nothing plagues us over the years. I hope we never have a famine.
Mm-hmm. So I give her the phone.
I want to be au gratin you.
I want to start you down the aisle. So I hand her the phone, and she sees there's words on there, and her first thought is, I pretty much put on Facebook that she shit her pants. So she was about ready to erase it. It took her a few seconds to actually go, oh, you
this proposed is the
proposal. To me. And then I got on the knee and gave her the ring, and it was a very touching moment. Oh, she cried a little bit, and it was a cute little thing that we loved to do. And on we took pictures. I took a picture up with a blow pop ring on my finger compared to hers. Oddly, that was way bigger than the ring I got her.
Yeah, but, well, you know, there's verbal shenanigans money, you know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, those revenue checks. I mean, every time it's like, oh, my God, another 100 people listen to Gandhi Jones. Wow.
Gandhi Jones.
Throwback. So.
Today our lives will be mashed. Sorry.
So we have
potato puns are probably going to continue the rest of this episode.
Yeah, pretty much. So that was our big moment, and did the announcements. Already sent out like invitations and everything. If you know, I think Izzy sent one to Alex. She accidentally said we were getting married in 2015.
Oh, you're doing one of those time travel themes.
Yeah. I'm going to buy the DeLorean.
The price
I'm like, no. I love you so much. I want to be married for you for 3 years already.
The prices were cheaper then, too. Like, you get a little.
Yeah. There was different management in the United States. So
yeah, you know. I know. The one bummer about your date is that, you know, the both of us can't come. We got, I have soccer season and she has work.
Yeah. I mean, we knew going into it, it'd be very hard to get anybody from other states. And like I said, it's just how the cards laid out. You know, we wanted to get married this year.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different schedules. And so, I mean, that's why it's a quick turnaround.
What's crazy is you can thank verbal shenanigans for your wife.
If you want to get technical, it was that last podcast where we first met.
Sort of. Okay. Yeah. But let's go back. Let's go back. Okay. So we did like the Watson radio show, whatever, the 500 names it had. That's where we met. Right. That's where me and you met. And you started doing verbal shenanigans. And then well into verbal shenanigans, I had met Alex. And we started dating. And then somewhere along the line, we're still kind of doing that one and whatnot. And Alex kind of pushed towards you guys, you know, dating and whatnot. I even remember us leaning out her window, like trying to see if you guys kissed each other. Like total creeper.
Yeah,
creeper. It's like little kids.
Yeah, I was very proud of your stalking abilities, you two and all. That's why I couldn't concentrate. I kept on giving you guys thumbs up. I'm like, no, get in the bushes. You got to really sell it.
So really, if it wasn't for verbal shenanigans, who knows?
That is true.
Verbal shenanigans, setting up marriages since 2016.
Yeah. Is it weird that you set up the marriage and you're still not going to get your ordained minister work in?
I'm ordained, man. I'm
I know.
I'm just an out of work minister.
Are tough, man.
Times are tough. But anyway, buddy.
Just a bunch of priests sitting around in an unemployment office. God, nobody wants us to marry them. Damn it.
Well, congratulations from the Brennans here and from the staff at Verbal Shenanigans. We congratulate you.
Well, thank you, Scotty. Yeah, it's very much appreciated.
We'll have Eileen in marketing send you a letter of, you know, if you're requesting time off.
Okay, okay, yeah. I already put it in the calendar, so it's all good.
Yeah, you got to put in your sick days, put in your vacation days. You know she's good. She's good down in the office.
Yeah, and that. She's part Jewish, so I got to get those type of holidays too now, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess at this time it's probably a good time to get into our first guest.
Okay.
We got a double Aaron episode coming up. You know, two Aarons.
Hank Aaron and Aaron Paul. It's amazing. Yeah.
Two Aarons, one cast. Are you
slightly
ready?
Disgusting than that other video out there.
yeah. Which one's worse? Two Aarons or never mind. So yeah, let's get to our guest.
Okay.
I'm excited about this one. This guy's got a pretty insane story. He was also a Winter Olympian in snowboarding. I believe the parallel slalom snowboard.
Yep.
He's a fellow New Jerseyan, so that's pretty cool. I don't think of a.
Nice.
I don't know how many professional snowboarders or Olympians came from Jersey. You know, like it's. I'm interested to hear how that all came about. And he had quite a crazy story with an injury and a coma, and I'm very interested to find out. All about that. So his name is Aaron Muss, also known as AJ Muss. So let's get him on the line. So Aaron or AJ, which one do you prefer?
Whatever one floats your boat. AJ is fine. If you want.
We'll go with AJ. So AJ, it's fun calling out a number with the same area code for once. You're a Jersey guy, huh?
Born and raised.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Now, nice. One of the first questions I thought of was. As far as getting to a level where you're an Olympic snowboarder in New Jersey, what was that like? Did you first get introduced in like your Mountain Creeks or your Poconos or whatnot, or did you have a different outlet to go west or whatnot? Where you know you'd think of bigger mountains, better mountains, and whatnot. How did you really get your start in Jersey?
So my mom and my dad were big skiers growing up, and. Like they took me up to Vermont and they took me out to Colorado. So I actually started skiing and snowboarding out east or out west and up in Vermont area. I never really snowboarded much in the Poconos, like maybe when I was younger a little bit, but I mostly got my start out in Colorado and Vermont.
So were they skiers or were they snowboarders too? Because I know sometimes it's like
they were skiers.
So. Did you ski first, or were you like
yeah,
the rebellious snowboard kid?
No, not at all. I skied and snowboard. I still actually ski, and I'm a very good skier as well. My father switched to snowboarding when I did, and my mom's a big skier. But no, nothing rebellious. I just wanted to snowboard. It's what the cool kids are doing, so I snowboarded.
When you started off, were you always into like racing and snowboards, or were you doing the freestyle, or you're trying to make tricks or whatever? What was your passion with it?
When I was younger, I did it all. I mean, I think that's the best thing for a snowboarder or an athlete like that is to do it all, and then you get good at it all, and then you start to figure out what you love and what you're good at and what you prefer. So it wasn't until I was like 12, 13 is when I started racing more and not doing as much freestyle.
So now
it shifted.
So when did the idea of, you know, hey, I can make this, I'm in the upper echelon, I can make this, if not a career, if not I can get to the Olympics with this, I can take that next level to being one of the best. When did you start realizing that you were better than a lot of the competition, or you were someone that people were looking at? At what age did you start to see a separation?
I was always pretty good without sounding cocky. Snowboarding just came very easy to me. It was something that wasn't very difficult in the time. And when I decided that I wanted to take it serious and this is something I wanted to do is when I started to progress much more purely in the aspect of I set my sights on something, I set myself a goal, and I wasn't going to take failure for an option.
What's your favorite type of tracks when you're going down? And are you more into the speed, the bumpiness, the obstacles?
Can you hear me?
Oh, we might
can
have
we lose him?
You.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are.
Well, now you're back.
I'm here. Yeah, I got you. So I definitely prefer harder snow and a little bit steeper is what I prefer. I don't want like one specific favorite track. That makes sense. I have favorite resorts or favorite mountains, but nothing specific when it comes to like a course. Like Pyeongchang at the Olympics was one of my favorite places to race. It was actually a very good pitch.
So let's get into the Olympic part of it. I mean, when that becomes a reality, so you did the parallel slalom snowboarding. When that becomes a reality to be on the Olympic team and something you've been training for your whole life, what is that like? Like, you know, like, is that a dream come true moment, or is it approached with some nervousness, or do you not really, or did you know this was going to happen?
No, I mean, I didn't know it was going to happen. I didn't believe it actually happened until I was there. But yeah, definitely a dream come true, because I love snowboarding and snowboarding's really fun, but becoming an Olympian was more important to me for whatever reason. I can't tell you why, but the thought of becoming an Olympian was way bigger than the sport itself. And snowboarding was my outlet to be able to become an Olympian.
It must be pretty exciting, especially considering like growing up, like snowboarding was always considered quote unquote the extreme games or X Games or whatever. To have it actually move into the Olympics recently, it's become one of the biggest deals, Winter Olympics, and one of the most popular ones and all. What's kind of the fanfare when you go down there? Are there huge crowds, and are people excited for everything?
I don't actually see any of that. I try to just stay focused on what I'm doing. I don't do my sport to be in the spotlight. I don't do my sport to try to please anyone but myself. So when I was at the Olympics or I'm at a big event, I don't really see the crowd. I don't see the people. I just focus on my goal and focus on what I need to do to be perform my best. That stuff is just there. It doesn't really – it's not something I pay attention to.
So the Olympics, you get to the Olympics, I mean, I assume there's opening ceremonies and getting situated and where you stay. How hard is it to, one, like, not get taken over by, oh, my God, I'm at the Olympics and being in a different environment and figuring out, and how much of it is just you can't wait for your event to start?
Yeah, I mean, it was annoying because our event was like the last week of the Olympics. It was 2 days before closing ceremonies. But I showed up to Pyeongchang. I went to opening ceremonies and I actually got back on a plane and went back to Japan during most of the Olympics to train.
Okay.
I didn't stay in the village the whole event. I went for opening ceremonies. Then the day after opening ceremonies, I got on a plane. I left to Japan to go train. Because I was able to go and train and it was quiet. There's nothing around. I was able to seclude myself from the media and everyone around me. And I was able to focus on my end goal and just trying to win a medal.
Now, what is that like being – obviously the money for a snowboarder is probably not insane. And like, is it hard to live as a young guy pursuing a dream like that and figuring out how to – to basically, I'm assuming you got to train every day, all day, or most of your time. Is it hard to find a way to balance that, like being able to make a living, being able to do it, and also just staying focused on getting to the Olympics? Like, how hard is that to survive for like a young Olympian?
It's not easy, especially when your federation and your government, or the federation, the governing body, doesn't support you. I get zero funding from U.S. snowboarding. They do absolutely nothing for me. I was understaffed at the Olympics due to the fact that I couldn't bring most of my staff because I couldn't get passes and accreditation for them to show up to the event. I went to the Olympics with one physio and one coach. That's all I was able to bring.
Really?
I was completely understaffed, and it was hard because I brought another one of my coaches, and he was in the grandstands at the bottom with binoculars trying to give me reports on how the conditions were because I didn't have the staff to do what I needed to do. Not that it's, could I have done it? Absolutely. At the end of the day, I'm the one snowboarding. I'm the one making those decisions and I can make it work and I can do it. But being understaffed and underfunded was a huge, huge thing in my entire career. And it still will be as I continue to snowboard due to the fact that U.S. skiing and snowboarding does not support me at all. They do nothing for me. When I go to races, like when I go to World Games, which are the top of the top, there's nothing more you can do in our sport. I
Oh, I think we might have lost. Oh. Hello.
Hey, can you hear me? Can you hear me okay right now?
Yeah, much better. Let me merge in mic real quick. All right. Perfect. All right. So I think we were at, we just left off where you were saying how you get no support from US, the US Federation, whatnot. So how do you make up the cost of, you know, because obviously if you're not training, you're not sharp and whatnot. So how do you make up the cost of that?
Yeah, it's all private. I do my own fundraising, my own money, private money. So I've sponsored. I'm able to pay for a lot of money. It's like fairly straight out of pocket. Which is just me being thankful that my parents are able to help me
right
with my career.
I mean, this
is what I've done my whole life. Like, I work, I've been purely making money to support the sport without sponsors, without sponsor money. It just wouldn't work.
I mean, it's pretty fascinating that you're saying, like, you know, it's the Olympics. We come around, we celebrate the American team, and you see them all out there, and. You'd like to think that, you know, like, you'd like to think that the athletes are at least being supported and, you know, given at least a stipend enough to live and focus on training and winning. Nope.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, there you are.
What's going on with my phone?
Yeah, we just like
hear. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you. You just like kind of like in and out, in and out.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm here though. I'm not so good.
All right. Did you hear my question or?
Yeah, I did. I heard it. Okay. It's incredible actually because I'm not the only sport that this is like. There's a lot of it for a lot of different athletes. This is the case. Like when you look at opening ceremonies, you look at all these athletes, and we're all wearing matching uniforms, and we definitely come together as a team, but. It's sad that we're not. I never knew a lot of the other sports. I didn't know some of the bobsledders. I didn't know some of the other, like the cross country skiers. That this really isn't. It's happening in a lot of different sports, not just mine.
Right.
This is crazy.
Was it like a popularity contest, pretty much?
Yeah, I mean the U.S. skiers get paid a ton of money. The ski racers and like the Chloe Kims, the half pipers, and they just, which it's like. It sucks and it's terrible, but at the same aspect, sometimes I do understand. I'm not as marketable as a sport as Lindsey Vonn or Michaela Schifrin or Chloe Kim. They're just more marketable people, so they'll give them more money to help them succeed because they can make money off of them. The Olympics and the U.S. snowboarding is a business at the end of the day. What drew me to the Olympics and drew me to my sport is purely what the Olympics means to me and in the grand scheme of things, what the Olympics does mean. But what it's become nowadays is a little jaded due to the fact that it is a business and they need to make money.
So let's talk about your run itself in Japan. I mean, obviously it's disappointing you didn't advance on and get a medal. I mean, how... Was it something where you were kicking yourself in the back of the rear, or was it just one of those, that was conditions, that's what happened? How did you feel going from there?
So after first run, I was in third place. So I was in medal contention, which was awesome. I know I have it in me to win the medal, and I knew I was good enough to win the medal. But the next run, my run number two, I made a mistake, and it put me in 20th, and that's just the way it was. I didn't kick myself in the ass purely because I left everything I had out there. I gave it everything I had, and I tried and tried my hardest. And I mean, what else can I do? What else could I ask for? It just wasn't my time. It just wasn't meant to be. So I couldn't be too upset about it. I mean, obviously it hurts. I'm not gonna say it doesn't hurt. I think about it every day. But
so
there's nothing I can do besides move on from it.
Is the goal is your personal goal to get back up and get back to the next Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still like, I'm taking this winter or this summer to really like think about if I want to commit another 4 years. Because
yeah.
4 years is a long time.
It is.
And I don't want to show up to an event or show up to a race and know why I'm not doing good. So if I can't give it 110%, I'm not going to give it at all. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
No,
if I'm not showing up to somewhere prepared, and I know the reason why I'm not being successful, then there's no reason showing up at all.
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating. We've had one or two Olympians on. And it's same thing, like one we had in curling, and he was a gold medalist curler from Canada, and yet he's still same thing, struggling to find the funds to do it, the debating if it was worth the next 4 years to come in. So I find the whole Olympic athlete thing absolutely fascinating, because it is so driven by you guys, like the athlete itself, like, do I want to do this, with little support. I remember Mike and I years ago did a comedy show for a speed skater. They were trying to raise money in Flemington for Kimmy Getz, I think her name was. She was an Olympic speed skater. And all the funding was coming from fundraisers and whatnot. So it is amazing. I give you guys like a lot of credit for sticking to it, because, your window is only open for so long. But you also have life, the cost of life, the expenses of life, and moving on and whatnot. So I do give you guys a ton of credit.
Thank you. Yeah, it's crazy. I feel like Olympic athletes are in their own kind of category of species of athletes in general, because I feel like a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us are purely driven to do this for ourselves. We're not in it to like support our families that are like make a living out of it.
Right.
We're doing it for ourselves. We're like an NBA player, a football player, an MLB player. That's how they make their living. They're trying to be the best they can be and make the most money they can for that short period of time that they're able to do their sport. We're an Olympian. Most Olympians, even gold medalists, when they retire their sport, they go work a job.
Yeah.
Because they didn't make nearly enough money to live.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean...
So it's crazy to me, and it's fascinating that how much all Olympians have something in common, where it's purely out of self-worth and joy of doing their sport and reaching a goal.
Now, it would be, shifting gears a little bit here, it would be insane to not talk to you. I mean, to talk to you and not talk about a crazy experience, that life-changing, I'm assuming, experience that you went through. I watched an interview with you and read up on you. So I guess it started with shoulder surgery in 2014.
A routine shoulder surgery.
So this was like a nagging injury or something you did on the slopes or whatnot, and you just went in for just repair like your truck.
Yeah. I dislocated my shoulder in the beginning of the season, and I just decided that at the end of the season I'll get it repaired. I was able to deal with the pain through the season. I like dislocated a few more times. I was like, yeah, like if I get a shoulder surgery, I have to stop for the year. So I'll deal with it after the season. So as soon as the last race was over, I went in for just like, I call it routine shoulder surgery, but they rebuilt my shoulder. They took a bone saw to my clavicle, cut my clavicle, and they drilled my shoulder into a socket. So it won't come out anymore.
Okay.
Instead of anchoring it.
A little bit more than a scope,
Yeah.
Pretty involved.
Sure.
Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that my arm will never come out of its socket, and if it does, it's breaking. That's the best option for me, because I don't want it coming out again.
Okay.
So I did the shoulder surgery, and after the shoulder surgery, they sent me home. And I was downstairs in my room at a friend's house in Colorado, which is really, really high altitude in Steamboat there in Summit County. I was like, 8,000 feet above sea level?
Mm-hmm.
And due to the surgery, they sent me home with, like, some pain medication. And what we didn't know about is the fact that I had a hole in my heart. So due to the painkillers that they gave me, mm-hmm. and the thing called a game ready, it slowed my respiratory system down so much that the hole that was in my heart relaxed, the muscle relaxed, and it caused my heart to start shunting. And once the hole in my heart opens, all the blood from the right side of my heart was going straight across to the left side of my heart.
Whoa.
Which then means it's not getting any oxygen,
right.
any air from my lungs.
Jeez.
And I just went into full collapse. And my mother, I don't remember any of this at all. I was dead to the world. I had no idea what was going on. And my mom, for some reason, I guess she went to check on me, which I assume most moms do after their kids have surgery. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, my mom went down there to check on me, and I was there. There was no, I wasn't even there. Like there was just a body.
Jeez.
And I was, I guess she tried to wake me up, and she, like, opened my eyes, and my eyes were rolling in the back of my head, like, completely not coherent. And then they called the ambulance. And when the ambulance showed up, they had to, I guess it's protocol, they had to assume that I was overdosing because they saw symptoms of OD and they saw a young kid.
Right.
And they gave me stuff to aspirate. And when I went to aspirate, it all went into my lung instead of coming out of my mouth. It went and it filled up my lungs and it popped my lung.
Whew.
And then when that happened, I started even collapsing even quicker. They rushed me to the hospital and they were trying to treat me at the hospital. But due to the fact they didn't know I had a hole in my heart, which no one knew because I had it since birth, but it just, I guess a lot of people have it, but you never know about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. Good to know now. They were trying to treat me for all these different symptoms, but they didn't know about the hole in my heart, so I wasn't getting better. And then they had to flight for life me down to Denver to a good trauma center because they didn't have like the best trauma center up there. So they went to a helicopter and a place, Colorado. Snow rolled in and the helicopter couldn't take off.
Jeez.
So then they had to rush me into an ambulance, got me in an ambulance, and then they drove me down to Denver, which is like an hour and 10-minute drive in the ambulance. And that's when I died, was in the ambulance, was when my heart stopped, and they had to revive me. And then I got down to the trauma center, and then that's when they put me into a coma, that drug-induced coma. And then they found the hole in my heart, and they were able to try to get me to function again, where I was breathing on machines, and the machines were keeping me alive. And they had no idea when I woke up if I was going to be brain dead or what the case may be. They said it was a very good possibility that I'd be brain dead due to the fact that my body had like 36% oxygen for a couple hours.
Wow.
Lord.
God.
That's crazy.
Now,
the miraculous thing and the craziest thing about this whole situation scenario is as fast as I collapsed was as fast as I recovered.
do you remember any of this? Do you have any memory of the coma or coming in and out of the coma? Like,
I remember waking up out of that coma. That's all I remember. Everything else, I know nothing. I remember, all I remember is the day after I got out of surgery, I woke up sometime in the afternoon, ate a Wendy's Southwest salad. That's the only thing I could get down. That is all I remember. And I can still taste that salad. That is all I remember.
Wow.
So, I mean, when you wake up and everything, is it like what's going through your mindset when people are telling you this story? Are you sitting back saying, okay, I got to relax and maybe take it easy a bit? Or is your first thought, okay, life is short, I got to get back on the hills?
Well, when I woke up out of the coma, it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. So I had no idea what was going on. There's no one in the room. It is dead. Like, there is no one around me. And I'm like, what the hell? Where am I? No idea what's going on.
God.
So for a couple hours, I'm just running through scenarios through my head, having no idea what the hell's going on. Like, what just happened? And I couldn't speak because the tubes down my throat breathing for me. But once everything came together and I started feeling better, once I came out of a coma, I walked myself out of the hospital 5 days later. I was not spending a day in the hospital longer. I hate hospitals. I walked straight out of the hospital as soon as I could.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Because they wanted to do heart surgery and I refused it.
So,
they wanted to put this clamshell in the middle of my heart to... so I could like live and not have any stress at all, but I refused it.
So what are the do you have any lasting effects from that? And also, like, what is how does your mental side, your mentality or psyche change after something like that, or did it at all?
Oh, it completely changed me, 110%. There's no questions about that. I mean, the only like things I have to be careful of is I can't take any long acting narcotics or any opiates. So, I mean, that's not too hard to do.
Yeah,
pretty easy. And then I just got to be careful with that, with any painkillers, any medication. But besides that, my heart seems to be pretty healthy. It's been 2 years, so whatever. But my mental outlook on life changed a lot. Like, I kind of not do what I want when I want, but I don't think of the repercussions of thing. I just have fun. I do what I want, and as long as I'm a good person and I'm having fun, then send it. Like,
it's unbelievable.
I like jumping off shit. Wow. I like going crazy. Like, it's just the way things are. I love it. Like, adrenaline. I'm just addicted to adrenaline, and I don't have this fear of death anymore. Like, I'd rather, like, I'm more scared of, like, breaking my leg than I am of dying. I'd almost rather die than break my leg. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's actually pretty peaceful. Like, you don't even know you're dead. You're dead. That's it. Like, you don't know.
Yeah.
So I'd never think of the repercussions of things, which is kind of a good thing, but kind of a bad thing. It gets me hurt sometimes, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I had fun doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we all got one life, at least that we know. I mean, did you get into, I also know that you're into Formula Drift racing. Did that come after this incident, or were you into racing prior to?
I grew up racing karts, like racing go-karts and racing shifter karts, but like drifting and stuff like that came after. That's why I'm actually driving back from Seattle right now. I work for a professional team in the summer to make money. And that's why I'm driving one of the race cars back from the event.
It'd be crazy if you had no interest in that, and then you had the Coleman and came out like a professional drift car racer. Like you just you just obtained this knowledge.
No, somehow. I just love cars. I just love going fast. I don't care what it is. I just want to go fast.
So let me ask you, I love to ask, we've had a lot of like athletes and different adrenaline, you know, junkies, whatever you want to say on this show. How does that affect your relationship with either family or significant others and whatnot? Obviously they're all going to care for you and probably support you and whatnot, but how does that affect your relationship as far as them worrying about you and especially with what you went through, and whatnot? Is that hard to balance, or do you just kind of like give them the, I'm okay, and then go do what you got to do anyway?
I mean, my mom and my parents, they support me in anything I do. My mom understands my outlook on life, and she understands that that's just the way I am and just accepts me for that fact. She obviously gets nervous because through that whole incident, I don't care what happened to me at all. Like, it happened. It is what it is.
Right.
I feel terrible for my mother because there's nothing worse in the world than losing a child. Like, she almost lost her son. I feel so guilty. Not guilty, but I feel terrible that I put her through that. Not that I did it on purpose, but I just feel this like almost guilt that I feel terrible and that I need to do everything I can to make her happy and to make sure she's healthy, because I like, she wants to outlive her son and I want her to outlive her son. But my little sister is similar to me. I think due to my accident, she realizes that life is short and you got to do what you want and live the life the way you want to live it. When it comes to significant others, they're just, I mean, if they like me, they're just going to have to deal with me.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking for anyone, so.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know. I hope it doesn't affect my relationships with my parents. I don't think it does. They support me in any decision I make.
I'm just always interested in the dynamic adrenaline junkie sounds like a cheesy term, but like, you know, someone who is involved with sports that, you know, potentially can be dangerous and things. I'm always interested in the dynamic of like that family relationship and what goes on during the meets. Like, I think of, we had a couple times on the show, like a Red Bull Air Race pilot. He always talks about how his wife's like, you know, very supportive, but they, you know, like he makes one mistake and it's over. And it just, you know, and he on his free time, he likes racing cars and going fast. I just always wonder if it's like a personality type or it's just, one thing leads to the other. Like, oh yeah, I'm great at going fast on a snowboard. I'd be really great at going fast in a car that drifts around corners.
Yeah.
You know,
I just think we're missing a chromosome and we're pre-Neanderthals. Like, there's something wrong up there. There is something wrong up there with us, for sure.
So, where do you see yourself, dude? Do you see yourself slowing down at any point in your life? Do you see yourself doing like mechanic stuff, or do you see yourself, I'm going to jump out an airplane in a couple weeks?
I want to go base jumping in the worst way.
Yeah.
And I want to go skydiving, but I refuse to go skydiving unless I'm allowed to go by myself. I won't go tandem. I want to be in control. I like haven't gone purely at the fact that I'm like, I want to jump along. You don't have to do.
Well, you could work your way up to that point.
No.
Just go there with a pair of scissors.
None at all. Exactly.
I like
it. No, I don't see myself slowing down at all. I don't want to live. So I'm 80 and I can't do anything. So if I die doing what I love, I'd rather die that way.
Right.
But Like other people say, with age comes a cage. So now I'm driving race cars and I'm surrounded by a roll cage. You know?
Well, I mean, AJ, it's really fascinating to talk to you. You got a lot of, I mean, obviously snowboarding is one thing, but you got a lot of different elements to yourself, and you've been through a lot of things. But I hope you do decide to pursue it, and we get to see you in another Olympic game, or X Games, or you know, whatever it is. Because, like, you know, if you can still do it, I hope you choose to do it. But if not, I do wish you the best of luck in whatever you really decide to do. And I want to thank you for giving us a few minutes on the show here.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you guys. I enjoyed it.
So if people want to check you out or say hey or see what you're up to, where can they go?
Best bet is to follow me on Instagram at AJ Muss and DM me. I normally answer all my DMs. And I try to post on there as much as possible. I like to live my life not through the camera, but just through Spanish. So not always the best about posting, but I always answer everyone. I always get back to everyone as best as possible and try to share my life through social media as best I can.
One last question. Since you're a Jersey guy and pizza is very important in Jersey, we ask people from time to time, what are your thoughts on pineapple pizza?
Don't let me down, AJ.
I used to like it when I was younger. But then I decided I wasn't a terrorist, and pineapple should not be on
pizza. Thank you. That's a fellow Jerseyan.
We'll see if this interview gets released. Just remember who has the record button on at hand right now. So. But AJ, thanks so much. Even though you let me down in the last 30 seconds of this interview, I wish you the best of luck in everything you're doing, man.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys.
Okay.
Have a good one.
All right. We should compare AJs that have been on our show and see what they have in common.
Well, we've had two Aarons so far. Did we hear back from Aaron Paul yet for tonight?
Remember, I told you we had Beyonce scheduled and Aaron Paul. But you know what? Like, you know, they can wait. Like, they can wait their turn.
I hear you.
They can wait their turn. But very fascinating, man. It's just, you know, like the Olympian thing. I've heard that before through multiple outlets, and I remember John Morris saying that. You know, like there's a gold medalist, but they don't make it. A lot of them don't make a cent from it.
No, well, that's a funny. And when it started, that's why there was a whole big deal. Like when the Dream Team came out, there were still these old school fussy. They can't make money on their. On this, they're doing it for the athletics. And it's like, well, yeah, well, some of these people go to like 28, 32 in age doing Olympic sports. You mean to tell me they can't make a dime off of this stuff?
Right, yeah. No, yeah, I'm sure the Dream Team, when they're like sponsored by McDonald's and their posters and jerseys that they're selling later in life, it's the sports like this guy. Like, I mean, snowboarding's big. There's Shaun White's and stuff, but he's in like the slalom snowboarding. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, and we had John Morris curling. Like, yeah, it gets attention once every 4 years, you know?
Exactly.
Unless you're like a diehard fan. But very fascinating, the coma stuff. Like, it's nuts. All right, Mikey boy. I think it's, did you ever have a nickname that you didn't like? I never liked when anybody called me Scotty, and I had a soccer coach that called me Scotty. And like all my soccer friends from that team started calling me Scotty, and I never liked it.
I mean, for the longest time, I hated when people called me by my last name. they kind of got to the point where it's like, all right, I'm not changing this. So it just kind of sunk in. I think for a cup of coffee, I was called Beans for a little bit.
What? Beans?
Yeah.
Like for what reason?
I remember it was like it was in a science class, and it was like an experiment for figuring out like the percentage for chromosomes and like how many times it will come up XX, XY,
Mikey Beans.
And you had to bring in beans, you know, because we're all going to put like a certain amount in each cup and separate it out. So just being a nice guy, I brought in like my My parents gave me like 5 or 6 bags to bring in. Everybody's like, what the hell are you bringing all them in for? What the hell, beans? What's up, Beans Berlew? And that was like a cup of coffee. It went away.
Mikey Beans. All right, well, it's back now because I'm not calling you anything else. So,
well, you can call me Burles like other people do.
No, no, no one on this planet does that.
No, that was proven.
All right, Beans. Who we got on the show right now? Who's this guest coming up?
We're going to be talking to Aaron Yoder. He is the head cross-country and track and field coach for Bethany College, and he currently holds the world record for the fastest backward mile.
The backwards mile.
Yeah.
So we've been knocking down his door, trying to get him for years, and it's time. It's finally time.
It took a good 3 or 4 years, but we finally got a hold of them, you know.
Our people work hard, so, you know, like our headquarters, when they got a guy, they get him. So let's give Aaron a call here. Mike, are you there?
I am here.
Mike, Aaron, hi. Aaron, Mike.
Yeah, very good. I think I talked with Michael on the over the internet or email.
Over the information superhighway?
Yeah, exactly.
We use the latest technology called electronic mail. So
yes, electronic mail. I'm used to the snail mail. So
yeah,
that's what they do in Kansas.
So. You guys have been writing letters back and forth for years now. We've been no, it was, working with
dear Aaron. I missed you. Summer camp was the best.
Hey, we were using carrier pigeons actually.
Yes. And, you know, our people have been talking to your people and all, you know, you're a hard man to hunt down. That's
yes,
what it comes
yes,
down to.
Yes, I am. I've been out and about, as to say.
You know, we had Beyonce Knowles scheduled for tonight, but we said, no.
We're clearing our schedule for this one.
Mm-hmm. we're going to shuffle her out and get Aaron on the line. But Aaron, thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show in all seriousness. So are you yeah. said you're in Kansas right now?
Yeah, I just got back. Family was in Italy. So yeah, I work as the head cross country and head track coach. And as to say, it's like paperwork is mounting. So.
So now, were you? Let's get to the beginning of this. Were you a track guy growing up, a cross country guy growing up, or did you, this something that found you later in life?
Yeah, actually, can you guys hear me fine? Is this good?
Oh yeah, that's pretty good.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I grew up in a track family. My dad ran at Emporia State University, and my mom was always a runner. So we grew up doing track meets. I have 3 brothers, and we all actually ended up going to Fort Hays State University on track scholarships. And track has definitely been a huge part of my life, and certainly the pursuits of running forward have definitely spurred and spawned the transition into retro running.
I guess, when did you first get with this fascination with running backwards, exactly?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I've been asked that so many times and trying to turn back the tables of time and figure out when exactly it began. But it was when I was in middle school, I was training for other sports. I did football, basketball, baseball, track, all sorts of sports cross country, and I bought this treadmill to stay in shape so I could work out on the farm, you know, later when I got back from practices. And I bought this treadmill and soon to find out that it didn't go fast enough. So I came up with a great idea of running it backwards so I could get a better workout. I mean, it just didn't go fast enough for me to really feel like I was even getting a workout. So started training backwards really as just a result of trying to get into better condition for other sports, really.
So now what was your, I don't know if I call it, what was your forward time like? Like, were you, you know, were you on pace to set anywhere near some of the highest records going forward?
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe in my egomaniacal mind that I thought, you know, I could be an Olympian. That was always my dream. And I was a state champion in high school for the mile. And in college, I don't think my times are really enough to even make the Olympic trials. I was coming close in the mile post-collegiate. I ran 4:04 in a forward mile.
Wow.
And, but really, I mean, you look at the time, and I look back at that, and I gave it my all and really went for it. And, you know, quite honestly, you need to be running in the mid-350s to make the Olympic trials and probably closer to 350 to be an Olympian in America. So really, I mean, the dream was great, but certainly with the transition to retro running, I've been able to go farther and do more things than I probably could have in the best case scenario for forward running, honestly.
So how long were you doing this before you found out about, you know, championships and there actually being a full on like competition with backwards running?
Yeah, well, when I was doing the backwards running in middle school and maybe some of the tail end of my elementary days, I did do a little bit of research and found out there were world records. Now, at the time, there weren't any world championships, but I knew that there were some world records. But I just thought maybe it wasn't, you know, maybe someone just decided they wanted to go run backwards and set a Guinness world record. And I knew that I could probably, if I were to train, break some of those records. But quite honestly, at the time, you know, my goals were something that I felt was maybe a little bit more legitimate. And I mean, I guess it wasn't as interesting to me as wanting to be an Olympian. And like, well, there's no Olympics in retro running. And at the time, there were no world championships. So I guess the interest in it was very minimal. But certainly, you know, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, yeah, I could probably break world records if I really trained for it, but it was definitely on the back burner. So I knew that there were world records when I was a kid, but there weren't that many records established. So to me, it was not that appealing to try to train exclusively for backwards running when, you know, I had goals and dreams and forward running, as I say.
So... When you start training for this and you're like down on the track doing laps backwards, and do people just see you and like, you know, they're kind of like, what is this psychopath doing? Like after a couple laps, like, cause I know if I saw you going backwards, I'd be like, I'd be kind of impressed by the time you got to like two laps straight going backwards. But at first I would give you some really strange looks.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. And I think that at first it was, there's a little bit of, you know, what are you doing? You know, and you need to run forward. but, you know, right, really, I train so early in the morning because I have practices starting at 6 a.m. that not that many people saw me doing it. And when I got to the point where I'd been doing it for a while, I hadn't done it that long. I had been training for it for about 5 weeks when I decided to break the world record. And after I broke it, it's kind of like the only time people really thought it was strange as if I was running forward, because they kind of knew me. The community, the college, and my family and friends are so supportive and have been, you know, along for the ride since day one. And I think that now, even after that point, it was only, you know, they'd only give me stares like, what are you doing? You're a backwards runner. Like, you're supposed to be running backwards. And then when I run into people that have never seen it before, I was kind of at the point where, you know, now I was running, I would be running, you know, I'd be sprinting on the track or doing some pretty hard workouts. And I think they in a sense got the feeling that, okay, this guy actually, like, this is how he trained. And so really, I'd get some questions, or they would ask me maybe after I was done with the workout, and they're like, it's just hysterical because it looks like you're running forward, you know, with your form, but you're going backwards. And I think that it was, you know, interesting to people, not necessarily weird, because they can see that I'm serious about it. I'm actually doing workouts, not just, oh, it looks like he's cooling down or warming up backwards. Like, man, he's just, today I was out in the country at training at a place that I like to go out to. And now I did like a mile down and a mile back, and there's this big hill that people walk and run. And this guy must have been watching me. He's like, man, I watched you go like 2 miles backwards and then back up the hill. He's like, and he was like, man, I have never seen anyone do that. That's pretty cool. And he must not have been around the area, because, you know, I was about ready to say, well, you know, I just got back from the world championships. I have some world records, but I didn't really want to, you know, sound braggadocious or anything. But I was like, you know, yeah, I like doing it. It's how I train. It's great fitness. But at the same time, I'm super competitive. And I think people see that when I actually am doing workouts or I'm training on a treadmill, and they're like, wow, he's like really focused. Like he's actually doing that.
Now, the transition from forward to backwards, like, you know, like, I played soccer my whole life, coached soccer, and I think of a lot of the workouts we did, like, you know, backpedaling, sprinting forward, back.
Yeah.
What, like, I'm thinking that it had to be a bit of adjustment. Like, I'm thinking, when I'm thinking of running a mile backwards or even around the track, it has to be adjustment on your calves, I would think. That's the first thing that I think about, going backwards.
Yeah, I hear that a lot, even from other retro runners, like, use this as an example. Like when I went to just got back from the world championships, like I was telling you, and I'm primarily a middle distance runner, like the 800 a mile are my better races. But I did decide to, on the third day of competition, you can, with no extra cost, you can decide to do a half marathon or a full marathon if you're really a glutton for punishment. So, you know, the American psycho myself decided to do the full marathon. So I did a full marathon, and I've done only one forward, and I just wanted to see kind of what it was like, experience that. And, you know, I really wasn't even, I've never really been that sore from running backwards, but I think the only soreness that I've got from running, and now that I can say I've done a backwards marathon, you know, my calves weren't sore. It's more your hip flexors and your quadriceps. I wore these very minimal shoes for the marathon, and that was one of the other retro runners. Like, man, were your calves just super sore? Like, no, honestly, like, it's like my hamstrings and my quads are what really are sore if I do a really hard workout. My calves have never really been sore from running backwards. So, but you think that, you know, that probably would happen because, yeah, there is a little bit more of a stability element to retro running and balance. It's kind of weird. My calves are super small, so I don't know if there's just not much they can do. It's weird. I've never, to my recollection, have had soreness in my calves. It's mainly been hip flexors, quads, and then a little bit your lower back, because, I mean, your posture tends to be a little better when you're running backwards, so maybe some back soreness. So yeah, it's kind of weird because you think that, you know, you think your calves would be the first thing that'd be sore.
Now, thinking about it, like Scott brought the one point I was going to do about like what muscles and exercises, but the other thing I'm trying to figure out is what are you doing with your head and how do you get that sense of direction when you're running like on a track, and like how long does it take to be aware of, okay, the turn is coming here, to kind of change the way you're running, especially if you're in a competition?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that, you know, a lot of people don't really think about or maybe necessarily understand about track is that even though all of these surfaces we run on, they're all 400 meters, but there's different styles of tracks. Like, you could have longer straights, more narrow turns, or more of an oval-like track. So yeah, certainly every track has a little bit different like shape. And so that makes the turns even either sharper or longer turns. And then there's some tracks that have a metal ring on the inside. So for me, I'm so used to running on the Bethany College Lindsport track that I know kind of instinctively where those turns are. You know, just orienting myself. But certainly every track that I ran on, I always go out and run several workouts or, you know, get a sense of when those turns are coming. If there was like a triangle, like some of those exchange zones, I know, okay, here's a turn is coming. But certainly there's a little bit of an adjustment for each track. I usually try to, you know, look at landmarks, knowing, okay, here's the turn, got to start preparing for that. But certainly the more time you spend on a particular track, you just get more comfortable knowing. And really the goal is to never look back. You want to be looking at those white lines, stay within those white lines, and then as the turn approaches, start anticipating it, you can turn your body a little bit. And, yeah, I definitely say that every track, you know, I think even the distance between each lane, like how wide each lane, varies from track to track. So, you know, there certainly is this element of adjusting to each track. I mean, they're all the same distance, but really trying to understand the turn and getting a little bit of time. Like the last two World Championships, our family, we always arrived 3 days earlier. So we were essentially, you know, had done several workouts at those tracks. Because really, each track is very different, and even the number of lanes, how big the track is. And so that type of orientation is very important as you're going into a, you know, racing competition environment. Now, like at 400 meters, you're in your lane the whole time. But other races, like the 800 and up, you're going to be jockeying for position, trying to figure out where you need to make your moves or, you know, when those turns are coming, which is very important. You don't want to get tripped up. So, yeah, I mean, that's one of the big things. It takes a little bit of time to get used to the different styles of tracks.
Now, I got a two-part question, one real quick and one the second one. Sure. So first, retro running, does that refer to just running backwards, or is that a whole term? And second, I wanted to talk about your Guinness World Record. Is that something that you call and set up, or does someone find you? We've had one or two world record guys on the show before. It seems like everyone's story is a little different, but yeah. So one, what is retro running referred to? And two, like, how did you set up the world record achievement?
Yeah. So the technical term is retro running. That just refers to backwards running. And like take the world championships, for example, it's the IRR, like that's the International Retro Running, basically the federation. So technical term is retro running, and that just refers to races run backwards. So instead of calling it backwards running, I guess the more technical term is retro running, and that just encompasses, yeah, just those backwards running events, really anything from the 100 meters and then all the way up to the full marathon. And I guess, yeah, there is some clarification in terms of world records, because the World Championships has world records that were established at the World Championships, but those are, I would say, those are unofficial, because, you know, they're, like, take Guinness, for example. That's a very lengthy and tedious and very particular process that you have to go through for them to make it official. So even though someone may have set a retro running world championships world record, you know, they wouldn't necessarily be in Guinness, because there's so much sport, and there's got to be witness statements. There's a lot of just technicalities you have to go through. On top of, you have to have pictures and videography, like really every step of that. It would be really hard to use a world championships world record, because really someone would have to be right beside that runner the entire, you know, coverage of that distance. So like when I broke the Guinness record, I had witnesses out there, timekeepers, and then someone was riding a bike behind me, I guess, or necessarily in front of me, and they were videotaped. They were just a couple feet away from me, filming every step of that attempt. And then it's a process of getting all the paperwork to them in a way that they want it. And that process it can take anywhere from 6 months to a year. So even though someone may break a world record at the World Championships, you know, that wouldn't just be recognized by Guinness, because that, quite honestly, it would almost be impossible to use a World Championships time, because the videoing of it and the photography of it probably wouldn't be the way they wanted it, and it would be near impossible to do that. So when I was Guinness record, I was doing that just by myself, with witnesses, because it's a clean environment where there's not a bunch of people around. And then it's the paperwork is the real massive project of how it becomes official. So it's not like you send them a text message and, hey, look, I just broke the world record. They want several, like, snapshots. They want the video and then the witness statements and then the timekeeper statements, the surveyor statements. You know, they ask for a cover letter, like a resume, and you know, a lot of paperwork so they can archive it in a very, very tedious way. So
it makes you wonder how many people out there that can break records are just, like, too lazy to do all the work.
Oh, I'll tell you this much right now. The record-breaking process is far more difficult than actually breaking the record. I mean, you go and run for less than 6 minutes, but it takes even before you break the record, you have to make an attempt statement saying, I'm going to break the record. And then that might take 3 to 4 months for them to open it up. And then it's a process of submitting all that stuff. And you have a case manager. So, yeah, I mean, certainly that's a very good observation, because I've got to the point with several of these records, I'm like, I don't even want it anymore, because it might take 3 to 4 weeks. When you have this soundboard that you have an email exchange, it almost like, should we just use carrier pigeons, or should we just use snail mail? Because it might be faster. And so the process, I appreciate it, because, you know, somebody, and I don't really get on social media besides Facebook, but, you know, you can see these comments. Someone's like, oh, I could go do that. And it's like, well, good luck with it. And then also good luck with all the paperwork, because that's going to take you an entire year. And most people just aren't patient enough to say, okay, now I have to redo in all of the paperwork and, you know, give it to them the way they want, because they're the ones that people know there's a lot of credibility in it. And now I know through the process of now a 3 world record, and I'm still waiting on one that I broke a year ago. And I just know that when those records do become official, I appreciate more the process, not necessarily just the product of, oh, hey, I got a world record. It's like, I can appreciate that I went through, you know, the rigors of their process of how to get that record.
Right.
And it makes me appreciate it more, knowing that, gosh, you know, if someone wants to go break that record, they're looking at a good year's time frame before, you know, they're actually going to get credit for it in an official way. So,
I'm hoping you have one of these stories. I got to ask you, has there been a time where somebody was like shooting their mouth or something and talking about how fast they were, and you challenged them in a race and you just beat them going backwards? And if so, were you like staring at their face as they were in awe as you were taking off on them?
Well, you know, that there is kind of a funny story, because just this last year, you know, I think a lot of the coaches and friends that I have here at Bethany, there was a baseball coach, and I was good friends with him, and then the whole baseball coaching staff. And this particular individual was probably more of like a sprinter, because he was a baseball player, but he'd get out there and run every day and, you know, run a mile or two, looked to be a pretty good athlete. And I guess in one of the coaching meetings that I was not a part of, this was the coaching baseball staff, I guess at one point this individual said, oh yeah, I can run a 6 minute mile. And I guess all the coaches like, yeah, right, you can't run a 6 minute mile. He's like, yeah, I can. And they're like, Yoder can beat you backwards. And he's like, yeah, right. And then they went and talked to me and they're like, hey, we want to set it up where you race this guy. And not that there's any animosity towards him, but I was thinking, hey, I'm all down for that, because listen, if this guy beats me and I run 5:30, 5:45, whatever, that's good competition for me, helps me with a better time. But, you know, if I do beat him, then yeah, I'm going to be staring at him, and I'm not going to talk any trash until maybe the last lap and I know I can beat him. But so we were trying to set this
When you pass him and you're looking in his eyes because you're going backwards, and his eyes are just getting further away.
And then he's like, you know what, I'm not even going to say. No, and so there was that visualization for me. It's like, you know, I'm going to be like looking at him while I'm doing this thing. And so we were setting this thing up. I came back to Nationals. A couple of our kids had qualified, and, you know, we were going to do this thing. And then I talked to one of the coaches. I'm like, hey, we'll leave this person nameless. But I was like, man, is he ready to do this thing? Because, like, I'm getting ready for Worlds, and I actually want to compete against somebody and see, you know, what I can do here. He's like, oh, no, he left. He went home. He didn't even do it. And so, you know, it was kind of funny because, you know, there's this sense of, you know, other people saying, oh, Yoder can beat you backwards. And, yeah, there hasn't been really anybody that has necessarily maybe wanted to do that.
Right.
And I'm all for it. I mean, I think that would be hilarious.
I see a good opportunity here.
Intimidating.
I see a good opportunity for, like, one of those viral videos of, like Uncle Drew or, like, Johnny Knoxville where he dresses up as, like, an old grandpa, and then you just, like, smoke people running backwards.
yeah, I know. That's right. That Uncle Drew, that would be hilarous.
Yeah. Well, you just let me know if you want to film it. I'll fly down there.
Yeah, yeah. No, that definitely, I'm definitely down for it. Now, I did try my hand at, I've done it twice where I went and ran, a backwards mile against forward runners. Now, the first time I flew out to Manchester, and this was 2 years ago preparing for Germany, but I didn't really know, I mean, jockeying for position and didn't want to interfere with people's time. And so I basically did kind of the fun run portion of it, but mainly against kids, and there really ended up being just a couple kids in it. So I wasn't necessarily against a lot of, like, forward runners, and it was just a nice straight shot. But then this summer before Italy, I went down with my twin brother, and he was training forward, so he ran in the forward race. And I talked with the race director, and he was super supportive about it. And so I got kind of into an age group mile race. And so I literally was running against, oh, there are probably 80 to 90 runners in there, and they're all running about 5:30 to 7 minutes. And so I just got in some really bad position, and I didn't run a great time. But I probably beat half of the people in that race.
Nice.
So I'm finishing with, you know, looking at people, and at that point I was in a lot of pain, but that was kind of fun. But awesome. I was getting passed by a lot of people at the end. So they're probably like, I'm not getting beat by this backwards runner, but definitely want to do more of that in the future. So.
Aaron, thanks so much for giving us some time. It's really fascinating how, like, you know, it sounds like almost like a silly idea, but how far you can take it and how much you can achieve doing it once you kind of, like, decided to set your mind to it. So it's very cool. If people want to go check you out or watch your clips or say hi, where could they go?
A lot of the stuff's on YouTube. It's like the Wall Street Journal, the CNN came down and did these kind of like video stories. So really, if you just type in Aaron Yoder, retro run, backwards running on YouTube, the world records are there, the mile world records. Guinness did a video of it. Actually, the 1,000-meter world record's up, the 200 world record's up. And then, quite honestly, just my Facebook page, a lot of people from the world championships have posted videos. So I really probably need to have some sort of website where I can put some of these videos. But so much of it's just on YouTube, and you can just find that there easily accessible. So yeah, YouTube, if you just type in Aaron Yoder, and you know, a lot of these video stories, which it paints more of a picture of kind of the coming into the retro running, and I think all these, and much like you guys that are doing great things with the podcast, and I was just looking through your resume and all the artists and musicians and celebrities and sports stars, and now you got this retro runner weirdo. anytime there's a chance for someone to, or any groups that want the story, because there's definitely been a huge support system here in America. We were in Italy, in National Public Radio did a national piece on it, and then like our local TV stations were covering it, and then I come back, and you know, there's all these great avenues to get the story out there and kind of put Kansas on the map. So yeah, YouTube is a great avenue, and then really people just reach out and try to get the story out to as many avenues as I possibly can, because just proud to be an American and do what I can to you know, take advantage of the freedoms that we have to run forward or backwards or whatever you want to do. It's really a great environment.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we hope you, you continue setting the bar higher and whatnot and finding different things to do with it. And thanks for giving us an interview. And if you do set up a website, it should definitely be like com.yoderaaron.www.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that's good. I'm not going to trademark that to you guys. Oh, my gosh.
We'll do the Uncle Drew videos. We'll do the backwards website. We're, you know. I accept cash, check, PayPal. It's all good, but
well, coming your way. Hey, Uncle Drew. Yeah, Uncle Drew style. I love that. That's awesome. Yeah.
So, Aaron, thanks so much, man. And this will be up like next Friday. So we'll tag in it and send it to you and whatnot. I'm going to become the marketing director of the Backwards Runner.
Yeah, well, I got a plan, too. Since it takes a ton of paperwork to get these world records, I'm just going to think of something that nobody else will do just so I can legally have the world record.
Well, it's funny you say that.
I can do it as slow as possible, but still get it just because I'm good with paperwork.
You guys still there? Are you guys still there?
Yeah. Hey.
Okay, I'm signing off. Let you do your professional stuff.
Oh, okay.
All right, take care.
All right, take care, guys.
Aaron Yoder, everybody. Mm. It'd be funny if he like pops up later when we're doing the other interview. He's like, I got a question.
Mom, I'm a podcaster. Get off the phone.
Well, it's funny you say that you know, you do easy work, because before the show, I looked up some world records that might be easily broken that are Guinness World Records. So I want to know if you think you had a shot at any of these real quick.
Okay. I'm down with that.
Okay. So the most CDs balanced on one finger. The most CDs balanced on a finger. You cannot poke your finger through the holes on any of them. Finger must be flat against the CD. So the current record is 50.
I'm not good with balance, and nobody has CDs anymore, so that might be hard to do. And it might be the world record to have 50 CDs, period.
Whoever still has 50 CDs.
I broke into an old Sam Goody jackpot.
All right. So that one's not for you. But how about this one? Most T-shirts put on in 1 minute. Most T-shirts put on. The rules are you can use any size, short or long sleeve, and you may enlist a friend to help you pull them down, though they must be put on one at a time. The record right now is 31. Pretty impressive.
So basically one every 2 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, saying it out loud, it sounds doable. I mean, it's putting on a T-shirt. You do it every day.
Well, 30, I'm just thinking that right. When you start getting bigger, though, it's probably a degree of difficulty is pretty hard.
I guess, and all, but we'll figure it out. And I mean, we'll do the paperwork, and we'll figure out the rest of the stuff later. Well, mark me down.
Like I said, some of these, you know, I mean, if you really set your mind to it, I think you can do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right. This one I think you got, buddy. I think you got this one.
Okay.
Most Jell-O eaten with chopsticks in 1 minute. Okay.
That's a very specific one.
Yep. The rules are any flavor, and only one hand may be used while the other is held behind your back. That's where it gets a little difficult. One hand. But if you could figure this out, what do you think the current record is? Ballpark.
Like, does it say like how big of a, like the little Jell-O containers we're talking about?
No, like size, like ounces or pounds.
Oh, okay.
What do you think it is? I think this is a breakable record, Mike.
I'm going to say a pound and a half.
If you could do a pound and a half, Mike, you would crush the record. Apparently, the record right now is 3.2 ounces.
That's it. Nope.
That's it.
All right. Now we got two. Put it on there.
Now, the real hard record would be if you had to eat a pound and a half of Bill Cosby's Jell-O.
Well, it'd be easy. You just wake up a week later and feel a little sore.
I wonder if you're allowed to take the chopstick and scoop it, like slide it into your mouth. Because then I could get a pound. You know what I mean? Like putting it down and putting your mouth down, like, on level with the stick?
Yeah. I guess he gets, like, a big, big, big bowl of Jell-O, and he just, like, bounces it and shoves it in on from the chopsticks. Yeah,
Unless you have to technically pick it up. Like, that I can see being very hard.
Yeah. If it's, like, Jell-O cubes, then it's like, ooh, shit. It might not be doable.
This is another one, pal. I think maybe over the next year, instead of like a challenge, maybe we should try to break some world records. At least do them on video or whatnot, and then know we can do it, and then submit it. So, most sticky notes on a face in 1 minute. Most sticky notes. Rules must use sticky notes measuring a minimum of 73 millimeters on each side, must be placed there by the individual himself, and must remain attached for a minimum of 10 seconds after the minute is over. May not be attached to the eyelids. Okay.
Okay.
58 is the record.
And what was the time for that?
A minute.
Wow, that's one every second. I mean,
yeah, but just like you're slapping them hard on your face. I think you
could. I liked your freestyle there, by the way. Forget about the sticky notes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I want you doing that while I'm breaking the world record. That'll motivate me.
I got you. We should like
Scott. I got the sticky notes. Throw me a peach.
We should arrange a time like either you fly up to Jersey or Georgia, and we'll set up all these records and give them a try.
Yeah. I think you should do the backwards hurdles. Oh, you should do 100 meters backwards hurdles.
How do you get sticky notes in the face and I have to do backwards hurdles?
Well, you know, I mean, you're more of the athlete than me. You're the soccer coach. I'm sure you have some kind of coaching style where you go, well, when the defender's coming at you, you backpedal and you jump in the air for no good reason to go back in their 2 feet.
Right. Okay, how about
that? I think that's why we missed out on the World Cup. We didn't do that.
We didn't have enough backwards hurdle training.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. How about fastest time to place 24 cans into a refrigerator? Rules.
All right, let's go through the rules. Go ahead.
Must be intact and unopened, must use a commercially available refrigerator, and it must begin with the door closed. If any cans fall over or end up broken, dented during the process, the attempt is deemed invalid. So 24.
Now I can... As you're reading these off, now I understand what Aaron was talking about. This seems like somebody wrote like a document for this world record. This is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked at the article. I found these kind of fascinating, too. The record is 9.76 seconds to get 24 cans in the fridge.
Hmm.
That's a lot.
I mean, that's pretty quick. You know, I'm going to have to like do some like can picking up exercises.
Is he's gonna hear in the middle of the night? Dog's gonna be barking.
All the babe, I got it down to 12 seconds. We're almost there.
All this soda and beer shooting all over the freaking kitchen. All right. Most tennis balls held in one hand. Okay. Rules.
Probably not, but I'm going to guess 7.
Must be placed one at a time with a spare hand. All must remain in place for a minimum of 5 seconds once the last ball has been put in position. You got no chance on this, buddy. 26.
One hand?
One hand.
What the hell? Yeah. How the hell you do that?
You gotta stack them up.
I can't even figure out the science. Oh, I mean, I guess, yeah.
The science is too much for me.
There's like chemistry and molecules involved. I can't figure this out.
All right, something tells me you're dead on this one. Most circles around the leg with a basketball in 30 seconds.
Okay.
You may use a standard size soccer ball or basketball, and any drops of the ball during the attempt will disqualify you. So 68 is the record.
Oof.
That's a lot.
Yeah. It sounds like something where I'd screw it up at least 4 in. So.
All right. I'll do a couple more. Fastest time to type the alphabet backwards on the iPad. So fast.
Wow, that's very, very specific.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the key to getting the record. You got to come up with something specific and like master it and do it over and over and over and over and over again. Must be attempted on an unmodified iPad with official firmware and may be typed uppercase or lowercase with no errors in between. Current record, it says currently under review, though. 2 seconds.
Two seconds! No, pass. Can't do it. We're going to give it to somebody else.
All right, this is one we can do together. Most leapfrog jumps in 30 seconds by a team of two.
Okay, I'm down.
Yeah, I can do this one. Participant must take turns being the frog, and each person must have both hands placed in the ground and the back, respectively, at the same time before a jump. 32 is the record. I mean, you're moving. You're moving for sure.
Yeah. But. Yeah. I mean, a little training, I think it can be done. I think it can be done.
A little like a tie back to the Shenanigans Showdown. I wonder what the fastest time around a track on a what was it, a bounce ball?
Like the bouncy ball.
Yeah, bouncy ball. We can get that, and then Aaron Yoder will crush it.
He'll do it backwards.
All right, here's one I think I can do.
Okay.
Fastest time to drink 500 milliliters of water. 500 milliliters of water. Must use a clear glass and no spillage. 2.35 seconds.
I think that's doable.
I think I could do it too. Because, like, when I was in college, I won like a funnel tournament. You know, it was one of my proudest moments when I was 20.
Uh-huh.
And
didn't get the diploma, but I got that funnel.
And it was a 2-beer funnel. Like, and I won it all, and it was going down in like seconds. So I wonder if, you know, water seems pretty easy. I don't know. I think I got that one.
Yeah. You'll probably still try with beer regardless.
All right. that's what I'm doing right now. I'll just do one more. There's more. We can bring them up next week. But the fastest time to assemble Mr. Potato Head while blindfolded. Must only use hands. What the hell? People do it with their feet.
that's my world record. Fastest blindfolded foot Mr. Potato Head. Mark me down.
He's got it. So must use only hands and must attach all included accessories in their proper anatomically correct position. 16.17 seconds.
Yeah.
Blindfolded.
Hmm.
Just a couple other ones. Marshmallows eaten in a minute, 25.
Didn't we try that on a previous podcast with KP and Ritu?
Yeah. That was not a pretty bit. fastest time to put on a duvet cover?
Okay.
Yeah, it says double bed duvet cover. That's a tough one.
Okay.
So it's spelled doublet and then duvet. 26.03 seconds. I think we can do that. Most coins.
I had to Google what a duvet is, but we'll figure it out.
Most coins stacked into a tower in 30 seconds, 51. Most times jumped into a pair of underwear in 30 seconds, 9.
And that one I'm curious about. So you just jump in and out of your underwear for half a minute?
Yeah, pretty much. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Most push-ups with claps in 1 minute, 77. That ain't happening. That's like some marine stuff there.
Yeah. Congratulations. That's yours, buddy.
So, Berlo, I think the chopsticks is doable. Maybe the T-shirts is doable. What else? The cans in the fridge, maybe. I think there's a record out there for us. And I think maybe this is worth exploring over the next year or so. If there's some kind of record that we can possibly try to break or come up with our own and write to Guinness and whatnot and see what we can come up with.
Exactly. This is how we get ourselves on the map. Not entertaining conversation, just breaking a weird world record.
Listen, we've tried that for 207 episodes, so we got to try something different here.
Yeah. It's not working.
But
Dumbbell is just past us. So.
Oh, yes. So let's take a quick break. All right. Double dose of Aaron. It's a double Aaron night.
Double header.
I don't want to bring the cast down. I could get into the Mets. That'll really bring the cast down. You know what? I can get into Mets for 5 minutes. We don't talk a lot of sports. There's been episodes where we have gone down in sports pretty deep, but we haven't in a while. I feel like we haven't.
No.
So I'm going to give you a few minutes on the Mets here. They, as far as I'm concerned, they have surpassed the Knicks and the Jets as the most dysfunctional franchise in New York, in the New York sports market. There is zero communication between ownership, between the manager, between the player. The players do whatever they want. Okay, Yoenis Cespedes comes back after months off of nobody knowing what's wrong with him. no one knows what's wrong with him. Plays one game, hits a home run. The next day says that his heels hurt, and then he's probably going to have like 8 to 10 month surgery on his heels. The whole time, they're saying he had a chronic hip issue.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that douchebag, guy eating up $25 million a year, is he doesn't want to play. He just wants to collect a paycheck. I'm done with him. He's dead to me. Get rid of him. They don't know where they are. They don't get much for Familia. They just trade him. The manager does post-game conferences that he doesn't even know. He'll say that, like, oh, I didn't know about things. I didn't know about this. There is zero communication. They are stuck in this weird rebuilding slash they have like big gigantic contracts they're never going to get rid of. Jay Bruce, a guy who hits 40 home runs, literally has 3 home runs this year, can't get on the field. Of course they sign him to a 3-year big contract.
Of course.
They do not know what they are. Okay, they don't. The World Series 3 years ago when we were talking about it seems like 100 years ago. It seems like 100 years ago. Listen, the Phillies, like I'll give you guys credit. The Phillies having a great year, right? You knew exactly what they were doing when they were rebuilding. They had to get rid of the Jimmy Rollins, the Chase Utleys, the Ryan Howards. It was done. They got a World Series at it. They had to break it down and build it back up again. Okay? Uh-huh. And suddenly their pitchers are starting to pitch. They got a couple of hitting prospects that are starting to hit here and there. They're catching a year where the Nationals are kind of weird, and they're in first place. Yeah. You know, the Mets, they don't know how to rebuild. They don't draft well. They draft these positions. Look at the Yankees. The Yankees are going to be good if they don't make any stupid moves for the next 8 years.
Easily. And it almost drives me nuts how all these teams are, you know, the Yankees want everybody in the trade market. And all these teams are like, oh, okay, we'll take your 35th best prospect. It's like, no, they're stacked.
The Yankees have a problem that no team has ever had. They have so much talent that they have guys in AAA that are supposed to be on the roster.
Yeah.
They have like Chris Drury sitting there like in AAA. I think he's up there now, but before that on AAA because there was no room for him. Like a guy that would be a good player anywhere else. It's amazing. And they didn't do much. They traded guys. Brian Cashman traded relievers. Like, and got all these prospects, you know, and they held on to the farm system. It's amazing. They are in the best position ever. The Mets are a disaster. Jacob DeGrom, what do you do with him? You could rebuild the farm system right now, but it's going to take a king's ransom. Do you sign him long term? Because are you going to find a pitcher like that out in the open market? Probably not. He has 2 years of team control. Probably, you know, like, but do you trade him and just try to reload and say, okay, it's an official rebuild? The Mets don't admit to anything. It's like, yeah, we're going to be competitive next year. No, if you're going to rebuild, you do it full force. Everyone goes, and you start from the bottom.
Now, are we going to talk about the two other magic injuries that came up today?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what got me on this whole thing. I almost forgot. I almost forgot, Mike. I was too busy listing all the other crappy things about the Mets. Noah Syndergaard, another one of my favorite Mets, but can't stay on the field. First, he hurt his finger. He hurt his finger, and he was out for 2 months. And now he has hand, foot, and mouth disease. Something toddlers get.
Mm-hmm.
Toddlers.
5-year-olds brought down the Mets. That's amazing.
Oh, what's next? Asdrubal Cabrera out with conjunctivitis for 3 weeks.
The whole team's got chicken pox. It's over. It's over, ladies and gentlemen.
I hate them. They drive me so crazy.
Well, surely there's a big name in AA that can come up and at least bring people into the stadium, right, Scott?
Yeah. What's funny is they have no real big prospects. And they got one first baseman that everyone's flipping out about, but they won't bring him up. They'll just let Dominic Smith and whoever else just sit at first base and strike out. And disaster.
But you're not talking about the big name.
Oh, Timmy T?
Timmy T.
Oh, well, Timmy T done broke his hand today. Timmy T's out. He broke his hand. God, although he's got God on his side, it might heal in like a month.
after they trade him.
Yeah.
They'll trade him to the Yankees. It's like, it's healed.
Just a disaster, man. And it's funny because, like, on paper, the manager, when they hired him, I was all about it. I'm like, it's coming out of Francona's system. He's a pitching coach. He's got, you know, it was with the Indians, a really good team over the last few years, all that. He talks. He has no idea what's going on. No idea. Oh, we don't really know when this guy's injured. I don't know. He says something. He makes weird decisions. It's a disaster. Like, your team, at least, you see the progress. You have been progressing a little bit over the last 3 years. You had a horrific 3 years that it takes to rebuild. Now, if you're the Mets, what do you even do? You got a question mark at, like, seven positions.
Yeah. Well, the smart thing about the Phillies is even, like, with Machado, I was ticked we didn't get Machado, but they were smart about it because the Orioles were asking for a ransom.
I wouldn't do it if I were the Phillies.
Yeah, the Phillies were like, well, wait a minute. We got talent in the farm. It could be just like a 3 month rental. Lord knows whoever gets out of the NL is going to get destroyed by the Red Sox, the Yankees, or the Astros.
Maybe.
So they sit back and say, we're not going to mortgage the future to have one decent year.
Yeah, I would
Machado might be available next year, and we might pick him up, throwing him money that way.
Not only that, let's face it. Like, the Phillies are a little bit ahead of schedule right now. They're catching a strange year. Like I said, where the Nationals are just being
Atlanta too.
Yeah,
both of them. We were supposed to be fighting the Marlins in the basement, the three of us.
Yeah, so you're ahead of schedule. A trade for a rental, which you're probably I don't think you have the pitching yet to get through a playoff where you have a 7-game series. You're not going to get all the way through that. Hold on and stay pat, and you guys are going to be good. You know, and Atlanta's getting better. Like, the Mets are just falling deeper, and it's going to be Mets and Marlins for the next 3 years. It's obnoxious. But yeah, that puts me in a bad mood. But I guess I'll just go real quick over. It was a weird week. I found out, like, you remember I told the story in the podcast of how I broke my teeth, like, one of the neighborhood kids I knew fell and it landed on my head while we were playing basketball. My teeth went in the street. That's not what the story is about, but this is a kid I grew up, like, playing basketball with and riding bikes around the neighborhood till, like, eighth grade. Like, a neighborhood kid. Like, it was, like, me and my buddy Alex, him, and this kid Paul. Like, we'd get on our bikes, ride around, and the other day, I just, like, I just see online, like, one of this girl, Jade, she posted, like, it was her prom date, like, oh, my God, so sad. And, like, I just found out he died, you know, and it's like, and now, listen, I wasn't close with him, like, through high school or through college or after college, but it was, like, one of the kids you grew up with, 34 years old, he was like, it was always a joke, like, he was my black friend growing up. Like, he was like, we were pretty close. And there's, like, funny stories about that, too, I'll tell one day. But, and I, like, asked why, and, you know, if she knew, and she said, like, complications with pneumonia. But then again, he had lymphoma, so it might have been, like, he had that. And that the other one, you know, the pneumonia, you know, was a result.
Took care of one, killed off the other. Mm.
So apparently he had 4 children. Devastating news. And then, I mean, it's just sad news. Like, bummed out to hear, like, one of the guys when you were little growing up with is gone, you know? Like, and I started thinking about, like, you know, I could think of, like, 10 guys from high school who are dead. It's crazy. It's crazy. You know? Just today, I'm out with a friend, and I find out that his wife, her cancer has come back. She's been fighting it for years and years and years, and her cancer's come back, and he's all devastated and, you know, like, very worried, and hopefully it's just, like, a different adjustment to medication and whatnot. And then there was that, and then on top of that is, like, we have, like, a family friend, like, growing up, like, my mom's best friend. They're, like, sisters, basically. So we always call them, like, Aunt Sharon and Uncle Joe. But they're not blood related, but they're, like, always at the house. They stay. My mom and dad go out with them every weekend, you know, like, to dinner or something. And he the other day had like a lymph node pop out, which I had, and that was the most scared I've ever been in my life. Mine just was an infection, but it turned out he had like very, very aggressive like thyroid cancer, and it like it was on the operating table for 12 hours the other day. They just kept finding more like in his esophagus and his vocal cords and they removed all the lymph nodes from his neck, and like now like he's lucky to be able to still speak, but he only has like one vocal cord left. Like, just like, what the fuck, man? Like, just three things in a row. Like I said, three. It was like one of those weeks where it's like, God damn it. God damn it. God damn. Like, where's the good news? You know what I mean? Like your news is good, but like, it's like all that stuff. It's like, come on. Why? You know, I don't know. One of those weeks.
Ah, man, there's no way of sitting back and say anything but really sorry, man. I mean,
it's not
usually comes in groups, and it's just
feels, you know,
it's a bummer for the world.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
It makes you reflect on stuff, and it's like, dang, you know, dang, man, when good things happen to, or bad things happen to nice people, and all you think, you know, the world's a
shame. And that's what it is. It's like, and you start to think, I think, like, why is it you and not me? You know what I mean? Like, it could be, or I guess the better way of phrasing that is it could be me. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it could be you. It could be anybody. And it's just like, you know, why you go through these things in life where you're grinding your gears and you're like, why is it this person? Why does this person have to suffer? You know what I mean? Like, this person's a wonderful person. Like, they don't do anything wrong. And yet, they're afflicted with this. You know what I mean? It's just this mystery of life that sometimes I think no matter.
It gets you.
Yeah, exactly. No matter what your mindset or your religion or whatever you do, it still at some point always hits somebody like, damn. You know, damn. Mm. Like, what the hell? You know, like, crazy. Crazy. But I don't know. I know that's a hard transition, but it's. But, you know, it's like one of those things that it's better to talk about than not talk about.
Yeah, I hear you. It gets it off the chest, you know. It allows you to reflect and talk it out, like therapy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in other quick news, we had I did a Verbal Shenanigans comedy show for Mendham Golf and Tennis Country Club.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
Were you raising money for... little Timothy and Cooper to go to tennis camp?
Well, you nailed the dynamic right away. So you rich white people, but they treated us real well, like real well. They had steak dinners for all the comics, and you know, they were very excited about it. And we had a bulletproof lineup. We had Jackie Byrne, who is the best host I know. Sean Morton, who can headline anywhere as a feature, and then Mark Riccadonna, who's been on this show before, who is just a fantastic comic. But we had an interesting couple hiccups. Like, Jackie goes up, I have her introduced, and she starts talking, and all of a sudden I hear like music in the background. I'm like, what the fuck is it? What is that? And I hear like Rod Stewart, like, Maggie, I shouldn't have tried anymore. And like, she's like doing her act and like trying to talk to people. And the music's like kind of like right underneath her. Like, it was pretty loud. I'm like, and I start going like, you got to get that. Like going to all the managers and waitress, like, that's got to come off now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and like a professional, she plows through it, but they couldn't find the remote. Like, for the speaker system. And I'm like, you got it. I started like, you know, getting a little like aggressive, like, you have to get this off now. Like, we can't, you know, this is not how a comedy show works. Like, you know, so eventually they find the remote.
No, Rod Stewart comes later in the event. What's wrong with you?
And then later at the night, in the night, Sean Morton's up, and all of a sudden the circuits snap off and no microphone. No sound. And I'm like, oh my God. And Sean, like a true pro, just keeps going, just brings his voice up, puts the mic aside, like, oh, we have a technical problem. and just keeps going and still has the audience. But I'm in the back, like running around, like, oh my God, we got to, like, find a circuit. Find, and there's four electric boxes. Four. So they're like, none of them are out. Like, they're like almost trying to like blame me. I'm like, no, no, no. Like, one of the circuits is out. It's not any, like, it's not like all the equipment fried.
We turned off the Rod Stewart, and that was the same connection to your stage. Not our problem.
So eventually they found it. They turned it on. They got a nice little applause. Like, that's the price of, like, hiring professionals that have been there, been done that, and, like, we'll just get through it and ignore it. Because, you know, those kind of things could have been bad, especially the first show there. And nobody really even noticed nor had a problem. Like, it was just very smooth. And then Rick Adana went up and killed, and it was overall a good time. They ended up tipping every comedian $40, which is pretty awesome on top of
it. Oh, nice. Well,
yeah. So it was a good show, and hopefully we'll be back there. And that was pretty cool.
Oh, beautiful. Excellent. So, that's good news. Yeah. So it ain't all bad.
No, nothing's – it's never all bad, right? It's always yin and yang, yeah. Right? But well, before we go, I know you got something. What do you got?
Yeah. Kind of inspired by such a crazy sports injury that went through for Aaron Muss. I have a little game for you about famous sports injuries.
Okay.
Let's see. All right.
Joe Theismann.
No.
Okay. Joe Theismann.
He'll come later. All right. So let's start off with this. If you kept up with the reading on ESPN, you might have heard of this one. During this year's Stanley Cup, Capitals defenseman Brooks Orpik played even after which of the following?
Ooh.
A, part of his left pinky was sliced off and reattached. B, scrotal swelling that required draining during periods. C, an eye injury that filled his eyeball with blood and caused temporary blindness. Or D, splinters going into the back of his neck from a shattered stick that caused infections and had to be drained in between games.
I'm pretty sure it's C. I think it was the eye thing.
It was A. Which part one? Of his pinky was sliced off and had to be reattached during periods.
Yet Yoannis Cespedes has bad heels.
I gave you one home run. I'm good.
Syndergaard has foot and mouth disease. I can't throw a baseball. Baseball players are the worst. It's one of my favorite sports, but they're the worst because their money is guaranteed. That's the problem.
Mm. That's a good segue to our second question, Scotty. Former baseball player Larry Walker spent time on the DL because which of the following?
Wasn't he like the first Canadian in the Hall of Fame? Something like that? I don't know. I might have made that up.
I don't know.
Anyway, go ahead.
A, sprained his ankle while singing karaoke. B, separated his shoulder fishing. C, lacerated his toe playing lawn darts. Or D, getting injured driving a golf cart drunk over a hill.
Ooh, these all sound like they could be Canadian things. A.
B, separate his shoulder fishing.
Was it a strong fish, or did he, like, run into something?
I think it was from casting. It just, he threw it, and his shoulder got out of place.
You know, that sounds crazy, but, like, as I'm getting older, like, the other day, I was wiping. And, like, I got a spasm up my back, like, all the way up my back.
Oh, man. Those are the worst. And I think I told the story once on the podcast where, like, I went out and I did some, like, walking around. And I did some, like, hiking up a hill. And I was, like, dead tired. And I got into my apartment and I was looking for some water. And I got a back spasm. And it jolted me so much, I flipped my head up and I smacked my head on the back of, like, that butter tray on the side of the door. And I was literally seeing birds. I almost knocked myself out because of a butter tray.
Well, come on, you got a monster cramp carrying the crate of
the equipment.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah.
That might be a future question on this.
Yeah, so even, you know, we always laugh at them, like, these crazy injuries, but, like, I feel like they're more and more common as I get older.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, people who sneeze and blow their backs out, like, stuff like that.
Yeah. All right, next one. Jessica Dubé received which of the following injuries? A, turf burn over her chest and stomach during a lingerie football league game. B, 83 stitches from getting slashed in the face during a mixed pair figure skating event. C, concussion from tripping getting into a ring for an MMA fight. Or D, bruised larynx during the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Championship.
Bruised larynx. B.
B is correct.
Yeah.
She got 83 stitches. Her partner was spinning, got a little too close, sliced her cheek and nose open. 83 right. stitches.
And what is she? She's a lingerie football athlete?
No, she was a figure skater. Most of these questions I'm doing in different sports. See if you can figure out which one is Kate.
Okay.
Paolo Diogo lost the tip of his finger.
Somehow your accent still sounds Russian.
Yeah. He lost the tip of his finger because which of the following? A, he was attacked after taunting the opposing team's mascot, a bobcat, during a football game. B, it was severely burned from a flaming torch in a juggling competition. C, his wedding ring caught on a fence jumping down from celebrating a goal in the soccer event. Or D, caught his finger on a tree coming down from a tree climbing event at the lumberjack event.
B.
I'm afraid it's C. He was playing soccer with his wedding ring, started celebrating, came down from a fence. His top of his finger stayed up there. They could not save it. And he got a yellow card for excessive celebration.
I remember they used to say that about like basketball players with rings on. They go to dunk and get it caught in the net, and it was like a danger.
Yeah, yeah, it's really bad. And that's why a lot of jobs force you to not wear rings during it in like warehouses and stuff.
It's just marriage, that's all.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Which of these four is not a true story?
Okay.
A, Mike Allstott sat out a preseason game due to blurred vision from burning his cornea opening a bag of popcorn. B, Clarence Bledin injured himself sliding into second with his false teeth in his back pocket. C, Darius Fassel got a toe infection popping a blister with a power drill. Or D, Adam Eaton went on the DL with a stab wound in his stomach trying to open a DVD case.
I think I've heard D before. I'm going to go with B.
Nope, the fake story is Mike Allstott with the popcorn.
Damn it, Mike Allstott. Seems like a big Dune thing to do, though. Like, I got to get the popcorn.
I can't wait for popcorn. Here now. Emily Davidson died doing what during a sporting event? A, falling off her boyfriend's shoulders, attempting to flash the cameraman for the Jumbotron. B, getting struck in the back of the head with a javelin, warming up for a track and field event. C, trampled by horses protesting women's suffrage during the Derby. Or D, internal bleeding from an injury sustained in the 1990s roller derby show Roller Games.
I hope it's C, so it causes some kind of like fight between like the animal rights activists and like the feminists.
Scott, you are correct. She died in the 1920s, getting trampled by horses.
I don't know why I'm celebrating her getting trampled, but it's okay.
Yay, women are dead.
Yay, dead trampled women.
All right, last one. This popped up today. Victor Espinosa suffered a fractured vertebrae in his neck and stinger in his left shoulder because, A, an angry fan from Chirico Unido jumped from the stands and landed on him after Victor's team, Huchapito won a crucial game.
Huchapito.
Yeah. B, his horse, Bobby Abu Dhabi, suffered a heart attack.
Bobby Abu Dhabi!
Yep.
I hope
suffered
that's real.
Suffered a heart attack and died during a training event.
If Bobby Abu Dhabi is not taken for something, it's taken now, guys. So, babuabudhabi.com for all your rubber shenanigans needs. Babu Abu Dhabi.
C, he flipped off his Yamaha YZR-M1 at the Phillips Island Grand Prix in Australia after hitting a flat back sea turtle during qualifying. Or D, he lost his grip while taking a selfie while hanging one-handed from Mount McKinley for a Red Bull Extreme Sports special.
D.
Which letter?
D.
As in dog?
As in
dog. No, you should have went to your favorite. It was Bobby Abu Dhabi.
No.
The horse that died of a heart attack while he was training, and he basically flipped off the horse as it keeled.
Bobby Abu Dhabi is a killer.
His last act was to kill somebody else. If I got to go, somebody's coming with me.
Joe Theismann.
I need my jockey to take me to heaven.
Joe Theismann.
You're correct. I ran out of questions, but somehow that's correct.
Yes. Did you make up the other ones? Or?
Yeah, pretty well. I mean, going through the list, yeah, I pretty much made up all the other answers.
Very nice.
On there.
Very nice.
Thank you.
There was a couple there that I, very believable. Very believable. JPP with his fireworks. Joe Theismann's leg. I'm trying to think. A bunch of guys have fallen down the stairs before. I know that.
Yeah. Martin Gramatica, he tore his ACL celebrating kicking a field goal.
One of the Broncos quarterbacks like fell down the stairs tripping over his dog or something like that. Or
yeah, there was that offensive tackle for the Browns who was out of the league for 2 years because a penalty flag hit him right in the eye.
Oh, yeah. Didn't Stuart Scott, he got hit in the eye with a football too, right?
I think that's why. He got hit with a baseball. I think it was a baseball.
Oh, see, I thought it was at like Jets camp or something, which would be accurate with their quarterbacks.
Their
accuracy. But Berlew, I think it's that time. I think it's time to put a bow on this. Anything to promote?
I will promote something you're in, Scott.
Damn it, that was my promotion. That's where I was gonna go first.
Oh.
All right.
Then go ahead. I'll have to figure out something now.
All right, yeah, I'll promote it. It's funny, we've been on the same page like 3 weeks in a row. So I'm going this time. All right. I want to promote a buddy of mine, a friend of the show, good pal. KP Burke wrote a sketch that is on YouTube. It got on Funny or Die recently called Conspiracy Farms. And not only is it hilarious, it features all my good friends in the comedy world, Jackie Byrne, Joe Carney, Joe Conti, Joe Fernandez, Natty Bumpercar, Kevin Garifo, and myself. I mean, I really think
it's... Scott, I know you don't like to spoil it, but I got to hear your line one more time. It was amazing. Go ahead. Try it out.
Conspiracy Farms.
Oh, Scott, I'm in there right now. I close my eyes. I'm like, oh, my Lord. I look around. I see Conspiracy Farms everywhere. You're amazing.
The best is that I did have like an actual line, and it didn't make the cut. So
I told you not to ad lib it.
Yeah. But yeah, Joe Fernandez, Mike Gaffney, it's a really good sketch. Go check it out.
Eddie
go give it a like. Just Google Conspiracy Farms. Very funny.
Yeah. Go on Funny or Die and look for Conspiracy Farms and give it a funny.
Give it a funny. Yep. Burley, did you find something else?
Yeah. I will promote October 13th and 14th in Bordentown, New Jersey. The 2018 Kilt Fest is coming back. Me and Scotty did a broadcast from there. A lot of fun events, a lot of Irish events involving throwing stuff, a lot of music, a lot of great food.
That's where you suffered your big sports injury.
Yeah, exactly. And all my cramp, man, my cramp. It was horrible, but somehow I made it through.
I drank water, put some electrolytes in my body. It was a long road to recovery.
Yep, our friend Joe Fisher, he was there with... of course, Mansquare Brewing and all, very delicious stuff there. So a lot of fun stuff. It's a 2-day event. For tickets, go to KiltFestNJ.com.
All right, guys. Like us, love us, share us, comment. Go seek out our two errands tonight, whatever. Just interact with us, follow us on Instagram at Verbal Shenanigans, Facebook at Verbal Shenanigans, and then Twitter at VS Comedy. I hope you like what you heard. Comment on some stuff, share, reach out, whatever. Tell us a guest you want us to hear, or go back and listen to our catalog, 200-something episodes. Guys, let's get out of here. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Adios, Mike. Take care.
Later, Scotty.
Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go blam. I keep on bum bam. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, stand somewhere down the lane. I keep on bum bam. Informer, you know, say that I'm a stormy, I go blam. I keep on bum bam. Take the man that says that I'm a stormy, stand somewhere down the lane. I keep on bum bam. These are the men who come in at the blow down the door. Rainy Capone.